Well, greetings to all of you. I'd like to start with just a word of thanks. Darren
has been invaluable to this study because I have furnished the material, but he's done the PowerPoints and also oversees them while I'm up here talking. So I thank Darren for that. And I thank Koyla. She sends out all this material, encouraging people to listen in on this. And I thank the audience. I know some of you have just been here either in Zoom or here in the church at every session. So it's been a great experience for me. Very much like any teacher, I learn more than the audience does. And it's been a real exciting thing to do, to dive once again into the book of Acts and to be enriched by some of the things I discover. When last week, if you'll remember, we concluded Paul, as he often did, attracted opposition, and some of them were laying false accusations against him, saying that he had brought a Gentile into the temple, which he hadn't done. And of course, they were angry with him because he was preaching a brand of Judaism that they didn't agree with. And he had to be rescued. The mob had attacked him, and suddenly the tribune came up. And why did the tribune come up and rescue Paul? Well, I can tell you what I think was the main reason. The Roman leadership and soldiers were always frightened over the possibility of a rebellion. The Jews were not happy, many of them, with the Roman rule. And so there was always kind of an incipient rebellion going on. And at times it flared up to the point of where a person would lead a large group of people in an actual armed rebellion. So when suddenly this commotion broke out outside the temple, the tribune rushes in with the soldiers and tries to settle it all down. He's not sure what it's all about. And he said some in the crowd shouted one thing and some of the others. And so he gets the soldiers to lift Paul up out of the mob and starts to take him back to the barracks. Now, Paul, never lacking courage, says, would you permit me to speak to this group? Now, a lot of us like to speak to a friendly crowd. Not many of us are willing to speak to a hostile crowd. And on another occasion, you remember in Ephesus, when there was a huge mob that was stirred up over the silversmiths, and their Paul wanted to speak to that crowd, and the people around him dissuaded him and said, no, I don't think you better risk your life in this case. So Paul is now standing up in front of this mob, and he starts off. And one of the things that I'm very impressed with as I watch Paul is how much savvy he always had. He knew his audience, and he always tried to address his audience in a way in which they would listen. And now, he didn't misrepresent anything, but when he was in Athens, of course, he would quote from philosophers and he would speak in Greek. But it says at this instance, he spoke in Hebrew because he was talking to a Jewish mob, and that sort of quieted them down. So he begins to tell his story, and he's going along telling that he's born in Tarsus, a faithful Jew, studied under Gamaliel, zealously followed the law, even to the extent, he says, that I was persecuting Christians. In fact, he said, I was traveling to Damascus in order to arrest and imprison, and he uses the term way, followers of the way. It's a very common term that we find in Acts. And all of a sudden, his life was turned upside down. A great light hit him. He fell to the ground, and there was a voice that said, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And he said, Who are you, Lord? He said, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. And now think about that for a moment. What kind of reaction that would start in his life? And he said, "What'll I do?" And he said, "We'll go into Damascus, and it'll be instructed you as to what you will do." Now, he was blinded by the light, so they had to lead him by hand into Damascus. And he's there 3 days before Ananias comes to him. Now, can you imagine what kind of 3 days this was like? If you had been pursuing a course, believing it was right, and suddenly he's having now to realize that he was persecuting, even consenting to the death of Stephen. So, remorse, is it true? And then, no doubt, he begins to think differently. And Ananias, a devout Jewish Christian, comes to him. He's directed, as we read earlier in the ninth chapter of Acts. And he begins to say, "Paul, you've been pointed out to be a witness for all the things you've seen and heard." He's going to turn around. Not only is he going to be converted, but he's going to suddenly be a spokesperson for this cause. And then Ananias says, "Rise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord." As was characteristic of baptisms in the early church, they followed immediately after a person becomes a believer. They're, like the jailer that Paul says to him, that he says he baptized him in his household. And there's many instances like that in the day of Pentecost. Peter says, "Be repented and be baptized." And it says 3,000 were baptized on that day. I don't think Peter did at all. There had to be a little help in baptizing three people, speaking as one who has baptized people. This is Paul now. And he's telling that story to this mob. And they're listening to him. I'm sure there was hostility that was still there. He didn't convert them immediately by any chance. But maybe, I think Paul was the kind of person that thought, if I could just reach some. He was willing get all kinds of attacks leveled at him if he was just converting people. And so he is going along, and he says, "I was in the temple. I came back to Jerusalem, and I was in the temple." And he says, he gets a vision. The vision says, "You're not going to be well received here." And Paul wasn't so sure about that. But then it was emphasized when the Lord said, "Depart, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." And that was like waving a red flag in front of a bull. All of a sudden, when he said to the Gentiles, that Jewish mob became exceedingly angry, and they simply said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he ought not to live." They weren't at all hesitant about expressing their feeling about Paul. Well, now the commotion starts again, and the tribune rescues Paul, actually talks about lifting Paul up. I can almost picture it, a big mob, and they have to put him up. The soldiers have to lift him up to make through the mob. And of course, the soldiers have some weapons at their disposal that might make a mob to be a little hesitant to try to overpower them. They had their swords, and they were soldiers. And the commotion, the tribune have the soldiers rescued, and they bring him back to the barracks. Now, here's something the tribune decides to do. We'll scourge this man and get him to admit what it is that he's done wrong. In other words, torture. Scourging is what that was. It even says they tied him with thongs. So he's about, by this time, the tribune has left and left in the hands of a centurion. You know, centurion were over 100 men, and the tribune was over the centurions, you know, the colonel and then the general. And so anyway, he's about to do that. And Paul says, just a minute. Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned? Paul had used his Roman citizenship very effectively on several occasions. We don't know exactly how he got his Roman citizenship, but most people, most scholars would say that it was probable that his father was a Roman citizen through some good deed that he had done, or maybe he had served in the army or something. And so Paul said, I was born a citizen. I've been a citizen all my life, a Roman citizen. Well, that's a real good card to have. I don't know how he demonstrated the fact that he was a Roman citizen, but he had some evidence of it, evidently. And all of a sudden, it changes, because they're not about to scourge a Roman citizen. Remember when he was at Philippi and they did beat Paul and Silas and throw them in jail? And then they begin to realize we've done something maybe out of hand. So they say to the jailer, let them go out of town. And Paul said, just a minute. No, they've got to come and they have got to tell me that they're releasing me. I don't think it was merely, Paul being angry and getting them to kind of, I think he did that for the church, because from then on, if people would say, well, that guy who started this church was a criminal. No, he wasn't. They had to apologize to him. He was a Roman citizen. So I said earlier that Paul was somebody who was quite savvy. And we all know the difference between being knowledgeable and kind of seeing the situation and knowing how to get out of it. And Paul thought, well, wait a minute here. They're about to scourge me, beat me. And I've taken beatings before, even been stoned on one occasion. But I'm not deserving of this. And they better realize what they're doing, because they could be in trouble. And sure enough, that changes the whole tenor of the little get-together they're having there. Suddenly, the tribune becomes, for the centurion who was overseeing the scourging, comes running back to the tribune and say, hey, did you know this man was a Roman citizen, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly the tribune sees that he's unbound and begins to try to make a little amends about this. He unbinds him. And but the tribune is still trying to figure out, what is it that the Jews have against this man? And he decides what we'll do is take Paul down to the Sanhedrin, and then maybe I can listen to what they have to say, because it appears there's some real strong, opposition to him. And remember that a tribune was not Jewish, and he was a little bit like Gallio. You remember in Corinth when Gallio says, this is a matter of Jewish law. I'm not going to get in the middle of this. And so he just missed the whole case. Well, the tribune, let's kind of picture Roman occupation. The Jews were not independent. They had been conquered by Rome, and now Rome has the ultimate power. But the ultimate power does not mean that you don't have to take into account the populace. in the 19th century, when many European powers had powers over African nations. They still had to consult with Africans, and in many cases, they had put certain Africans in pretty important positions of power under their thumb, as it were. And so the Sanhedrin was composed of the high priest, and these were people that were not viewed very favorably by many of the Jewish people, what we would think of today as sellouts. They had sort of kowtowed to the Romans, and they were in league with the Romans, and they had some power. You know, they could, technically they were not permitted to execute people. Now they execute people sometimes with a mob action. That's happened in our country at times, where a mob just has gotten somebody out of jail and killed them. Even the founder of the Mormon Church, Joseph Smith, was in a jail in Nauvoo, Illinois, and suddenly a mob came in and tore him out of the jail and killed him. And of course, many instances of in the South of African Americans who were just lynched without any trial. So this the relationship between the Roman power and the Jewish populace was always a little touchy. For one thing, the Romans collected taxes off of them. That's why tax collectors, these were Jews who were collecting taxes for the Romans, were not really favorably viewed by many of their fellow citizens. These guys are sellouts. They're taking money. And we're not talking about taking money from rich people. We're talking about taking money from poor farmers and people who were just barely getting by, but they still had to pay their taxes. And I'm trying to picture this uneasy relationship between the Jewish populace and the Roman army. And there was always Roman soldiers and army that enforced the peace. And eventually, of course, many decades after this time, in 70 AD, the Jews did rebel. And they held out for about 2 years in Jerusalem. And finally, they were crushed by the Roman army. And when I say crushed, many of them were killed, and literally thousands were enslaved. So it was unlike our American Revolution, which proved to be successful. That was, the Jewish Revolution was not successful. And I want you to get that sense, because it's going to really, as we go through the rest of the book of Acts, we're going to see that Paul is always a prisoner. Now, he's not a prisoner like we think of today. He was kind of more under house arrest. He could receive people, but he starts off being imprisoned in Jerusalem. He's then imprisoned in Caesarea, as we'll see, and then finally goes to Rome. And that will be toward the end of the book of Acts that we'll get to in the coming weeks. Well, the tribune, and by the way, it does later give his name, Claudius Lysias. The Roman emperor at this time was Claudius, so he probably had a pretty good relationship with Claudius. Maybe he'd done some favor, but he took that as his name, Claudius Lysias. And he says, okay, I haven't been able to scourge this man. I thought I could torture him and get him to confess what he's doing that's created all this terrible mob action. But I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to send him now to stand before the Sanhedrin. And maybe at that time we'll determine what the problem is. So Paul, and I don't know exactly how Roman law went, but it appears that the defense, and in this case, Paul is the defense, he's the one being accused, had the right to speak for himself. It doesn't mention Paul hiring a defense attorney or anything like that. Paul felt for one reason, Paul always felt he could pretty well defend himself. I would have to say that he didn't lack courage. So he begins this speech by proclaiming that he had lived before God with all good conscience up to this day. Well, the high priest says, strike that man in the mouth. And I don't know if it was before or after the strike happened, but this Paul looks at him in a very angry way and says, you white wall. He said, you're doing something contrary to the law. Now, the only time I remember white wall being used in the New Testament was one time Jesus called the Pharisees as being like a white wall sepulcher. Said, you have a beautiful white wall on the outside, but inwardly you're full of dead men's bones. So maybe that's what this means. But all I know is that he really rebukes him. Well, somebody says, don't you know you're talking to the high priest? And Paul says, oh, I didn't know that. So he kind of apologizes, saying that I would have spoken so harshly of a ruler. One thing I want to say here, and we often feel like that the heroes of the Bible, whether we're talking about Moses or David or Daniel or whatever, they could do no wrong. So, but Luke is just relating what happened. He doesn't say Paul was a little too angry or anything, and I'm not going to try to guess this, but all I know is that Paul himself felt like maybe I shouldn't have been so harsh, that this is a ruler. Well, now he speaks before the Sanhedrin. And what he does is very cagey. He starts off and he said, I'm a Pharisee. I've been raised a Pharisee. And it's the hope of the resurrection that's got me in trouble. Well, you know enough about Bible history to know the Pharisees believed in the resurrection of the dead and the Sadducees didn't. So all of a sudden, he's got this audience who's, prosecuting him, but they turn on one another. Now, the biggest crowd in that group was the Sadducees. They were not as numerous as the Pharisees, but they were the ones who had power. And some of the Pharisees said, well, we don't find anything wrong with this man. So, and then they go on to say, who knows, maybe a spirit or maybe an angel spoke to him. That reminds me of that story back in earlier Acts of Gamaliel. Remember when they were going to, the Sanhedrin was very upset and was really thinking about doing some pretty serious damage to Peter and John. And Gamaliel said, let's just calm down here a minute. If these men are not from God, this will die out. But suppose they are from God. We don't want to be against God. And so they then rebuke Peter and John, but they don't take quite as drastic an action, which is a kind of illustration of how that sometimes a calm word can cool down a crowd a little bit. Well, now, of course, this has created another commotion. And once again, the tribune, with a great clamor that was going on, an argument between the Pharisees and Sadducees, once again, he rescues Paul and now takes him back to the barracks. If you put yourself in this tribune's shoes, you kind of think he's thinking, I don't know what it is about this man, but everywhere he goes, there's trouble. And back and forth. But one of the things, and let's keep in mind, Paul's life was at stake here. So it would call for, if I'm in great danger, I think my ability to think is sharpened just a little bit when so much is at stake. So Paul is sharp enough on different occasions to more or less say, well, you know, well, I'm a Pharisee, and all of a sudden, he's gotten them divided among themselves. But it was such a tumult that once again, the tribune rescues Paul, takes him back to the barracks. Now there's a Jewish plot. There are 40 men, over 40 men, it says, that took a vow. And they said, we will not eat. We're going to fast until we kill this man. And they had a pretty, interesting plot. They said, they go to the Sanhedrin, to the chief priest and so forth, and they say, now, what I want you to do is you say you'd like for Paul to come back for further investigation. But on the way, we are going to grab Paul and kill him. And normally, I would think that there'd be only two or three soldiers that would be walking Paul back to the Sanhedrin. And so 40 men could easily have killed Paul. But once again, and we may want to talk about providence here, but here, Paul, it says he had a nephew. Now, I don't find much else in the Bible about Paul's relatives. We know that he was raised in a Jewish family, no doubt went to the synagogue regularly in Tarsus, had studied under Gamaliel. But his sister's son hears about this plot. I don't know whether his sister was in some fairly high position and could find that out, but I gather that whatever her views were religiously, or the nephew, or the old saying, blood runs thicker than water. So the nephew doesn't want to see his uncle mobbed and killed. And so he goes and talks to Paul and shares this plot. And Paul says, nephew, and we don't even know what his name was, nephew, go in and tell the tribune this. So the nephew goes in and tells the tribune about this plot. And the tribune, after hearing it, says to the nephew, don't tell anyone that you've talked to me about this. Because now the tribune realizes he's got a real problem on his hand. And what is that problem? Well, let's say that Paul, they are successful and they kill Paul. On the other hand, the word could go back to Rome. That man was a Roman citizen. And you didn't protect him. And a mob, once a mob gets out of control, no telling what they're liable to do next. So Claudius Lysias knows he's got a problem. And any of us who have been in public life can sort of sense all of this. It's going to look what we might call intrigue. By the way, if you're someone and you're interested in the law, from now on, you're going to see a lot of trials going on. We're like watching a Perry Mason segment on TV in the past. There's a lot of trickery, and Paul is really fighting for his life, but he's also never misses a chance to preach the gospel. With Paul, there's one aim he has in life, and he is a person who bears the good news that Jesus is the Christ, he is the Messiah, he's the Son of God, he's the fulfillment of all of the Jewish prophecies. And he brings this out when he's talking to a Jewish audience about, you know, like the suffering servant that's brought out in Isaiah and other places in the Old Testament. Even there was a prophecy that had to do with the king riding on a colt and so forth. So there's a lot of ways in which Paul, being so versed in the Hebrew Bible, he had no trouble saying, wait a minute, this man is the Messiah. This is what you've been looking for. Now, admittedly, you thought a Messiah is going to be a king. You thought that the Messiah was going to free us from the Romans. But it's a different, God's plan is different from what you have pictured. And now that I've had an event on the Damascus Road that's convinced me that I was all wrong. There's something about Paul to be greatly admired about that for somebody. You know, it's not always easy to just say, I was wrong. I believe this and I don't believe this anymore. You know, it's kind of like taking a Ku Klux Klaner and turning him into a civil rights activist. You know, pretty hard to do. So anyway, Paul is someone who has now he has a plot against him. Well, Claudius Lysias decides what he's going to do. And that is, he decides that he's going to send Paul to Felix. Now, Felix was the governor of the whole area, like Pontius Pilate and so forth. The Romans had, normally, in every area, they would have a governor that would answer to the emperor. But the tribune knew that Felix was the guy who had the most power. And he thought, I'm going to send him to Felix. And so what does he do? Well, he gets together a huge guard that protects Paul. He's sending him to Caesarea, and it's about 100 miles, I understand, between Jerusalem and Caesarea. Caesarea was a seaport. Caesarea was a Roman city because, you know, the word Caesar obviously is in, and it was really a lot of Roman power there. That was the center of Rome. Now, they often had to come to Jerusalem in order to settle things and so forth, but that's where the governor generally resided. So he gets together 470 men, and it tells us what, 200 soldiers, 200 spearmen, and 70 horsemen. And furthermore, he decides to depart at night, making it more difficult for the mob that was setting to kill Paul to learn about what was going to happen. So he's already sworn the nephew to secrecy. Don't let them know that I know about this. And then he gets together this huge group to guard Paul. And Paul then is taken by night to Felix, the governor. So Paul now is going to spend quite a bit of time, at least 2 years, in Caesarea, and then he's going to spend time in Rome. So we've got Paul as a prisoner first in Jerusalem, and then secondly, in Caesarea, and then finally in Rome itself. Now, the tribune, Claudius Lysias, sends a letter with Paul. He said, I didn't find anything in this man that was deserving of death and imprisonment. But his accusers ought to have the opportunity to state their case against him. So he recommends to Felix that Felix permit the accusers, the Jewish accusers, to come to Caesarea and present their case. Although Felix also makes it very clear that Paul will be given the opportunity to defend himself. So he's saying, in effect, they didn't seem to have a jury system in that time. It's just a matter, we go in front of the governor, and the governor's going to decide, just like Pontius Pilate, it was when they finally decide they want to execute Jesus, and they didn't have the right to execute Jesus, they put him in front of Pontius Pilate. And Pilate's never convinced that Jesus is guilty, but finally, in that dramatic act, he washes his hands of the deal. So, okay. And, these are, in fact, one of the most interesting statements Pilate says. Jesus says something about the truth, and Pilate says, what is truth? Just kind of cynical, I'm not working in the area of truth. I'm working in the area of power, and I happen to have the power here. And, but he didn't have enough strength to stand up against, I'll just let them kill this man since they're so bent on it. Because if I don't allow them to do that, then there could be a lot more commotion and so forth. And so we have, in the case of Pilate, just a very crass decision. I'm giving in to the people here. Despite the warning that his wife said she'd had a dream about this man and he wasn't guilty, and Pilate himself realized that he wasn't guilty, but those of us who think that things are always settled on the basis of justice are a little bit naive. Even in our courts, we know that sometimes the courts make a mistake. Sometimes an innocent man is sent to prison and for a long period of time, or sometime maybe in many instances, a guilty man is not found guilty. We're glad we live in a land of law. Paul, in fact, in the 13th chapter of Romans, points out that a law is good. And none of us would want to live in a society that was without law. That'd be anarchy, chaos, and all kinds of. And even in ancient, very ancient times, when you had primitive people within their tribe, they normally had a law. It was not necessarily written in stone or anything, but there was a law. You weren't to murder somebody of your own tribe. And normally there were elders that would sort of get together and make a decision about when a quarrel broke out within the tribe. So, but we began to see in this a picture of the fallibility of law. And you don't have to dig very deep in the history of any nation to understand that law is never, the law may be well written, but they're just human beings that are enforcing the law. And we know that that doesn't always work out. So anyway, in this letter, Claudius Lysias recommends to Felix that he allow Paul's accusers to come to Caesarea and bring their accusation. But he assures Paul that you'll have an opportunity to defend yourself. So we come then, and it says he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. That was really an old palace that had been built by Herod the Great, the Praetorium. And so Paul is given, once again, some privileges. He's not chained. Now, when he was in Philippi, you remember they'd even put him in stocks, he and Silas, and in cell. But it doesn't, when you read this and you read even that in Rome, Paul is treated with dignity. Perhaps his Roman citizenship was helpful in that. And Paul was a very articulate defender of himself. If you were choosing somebody who'd make a good lawyer, Paul would make a good lawyer. Because look at him when he gets in there and turns the Pharisees against the Sadducees. Later on, you'll see his decision to appeal to Caesar, which he had a right to do. And this will be brought out.